the non-dual teaching can be very misleading because it can send the message that suffering is an expression of, is simply an expression of this belief in separation. So if you're struggling with depression or panic attacks or whatever, from sometimes the non-dual teaching can send you the message that's because you believe that you're a separate self. So all you need to do is get rid of that belief, and then everything will be hunky-dory. And it doesn't work that way. So sometimes it does. Or rather, at some level it does. It's always a refuge because our true nature is peace and openness and welcoming. So it's always the place we can go to when invited, because really we can't go to it. It's more like suddenly there's a feeling of just resting and abiding, and we're graced with the remembrance that all is well.
Hi, I'm Ricky DeRiz, and welcome to episode 29 of the Mind That Ego podcast, where I'm joined by Ellen Emmett. Ellen offers meetings and retreats in the Awakening Body, a direct exploration of experience sourced in the non-dual tradition of Kashmir Shaivism, authentic movement, and self-inquiry. In addition, she has a private practice as a psychotherapist and facilitator of authentic movement. Her journey of discovery has led her to therapy, workshops and gatherings with esteemed Jungian analyst Marion Woodman, and direct non-dual teachings from Frances Lucille. Well, welcome to the podcast, Ellen. Really happy to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
I'd like for us to explore the shadow and non-duality. This is something we discussed beforehand as a topic, and to look at how these things reconcile together. And I'd like for us to begin maybe with some of your background in terms of non-duality and how you came across that path, and how you also then saw the need to reconcile the shadow, or saw the apparent contradictions with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good area of investigation, I think, but complex. So I'll start with your first question, which is how I encountered the non-dual path. You know what? It's hard to pinpoint, but I was like anybody else, seeking and suffering, or suffering and seeking. I don't know which order those two come in. And I went to India, and I was looking for relief, but also I was driven by a sort of spiritual or devotional streak, and they're very intertwined, those two things. They're not separate. Anyway, one thing leading to the next. I mean, I could give you my whole sort of spiritual biography, but I'm not going to. But it was more of a devotional query to begin with. I went to India and visited some ashrams, and then for some reasons, a friend of mine, somebody I met on a kirtan workshop with Krishna Das, this person thought I would like a teacher called Frances Lucille, who you may have heard of. Anyway, he was convinced I would like him. And I kept saying, well, no, I don't think so, because this, here's a man and he's French, and I was sort of half French and an engineer. And I thought, no, that sounds way too heady for me. I don't think so. Anyway, my friend insisted, and he gave me like a huge box of tapes of Frances. And so I thought, okay, I better sort of trust the universe. And I listened to, randomly picked a tape out of the box and put it in my car in one of the, you know, the tape decks they used to have in the car. I'm old.
Yeah, old school cassette. Anyway,
and I heard Frances in the middle of a sentence say, I remember the words, he said, consciousness knowing itself. And I had a sort of glimpse. I had a moment. And I was hooked. Hooked in the way that a glimpse, a very short glimpse, can hook you, where you know, it's a bit like falling in love. It's like something's happened, and now you have to follow that lead. And I did. And I was lucky enough that I was living in California then, and Frances was also in California. So I just started going to retreats, and I really, for a long time, and I still respect and love Frances Lucille's teaching, and But for a long time, that was all there was. I was completely, I was just immersed in that teaching, and with Francis and with the community there, which was actually lovely. And part of the teaching, he's a student of Jean Klein. Jean Klein was also in the Nandal tradition, and he brought in the Kashmir Shaivist line or tradition, which really is also encompasses the body or the tactile level. So it's quite a sort of full exploration of our experience and of our direct experience, not just with our minds, but also at the level of feelings and tactility. And so I was in heaven because I also always felt very strongly about the body. So that was that. But then at the same time, I was a therapist. I was struggling with an eating disorder for many, many years. And I was very interested in the psyche in the human psyche. I was passionate really about certain elements of our experience that really didn't figure in the non-dual teaching. And I was just having to make my peace with that. It's almost like I had to compartmentalize. I would go to the non-dual retreats, and then I would be doing my psychological explorations and work, etc. And over the years, I've really, again, more organic. It's not been a sort of conscious decision, but for me, they've blended more and more. I've understood that there isn't such an arbitrary separation between the place where you meditate and you just recognize your true nature, and everything, the content of experience just dissolves or is irrelevant. And then another space where you're very much with your experience, what's happening in your life, in your relationships, your difficulties, your struggles, and you wrestle with them, and it's one or the other. And now I see it more as one and the other. And not only that, but I think that the exploration of our shadow, and I guess we'll talk more about that, but the exploration of that territory, which is the place where we can't bring certainty. It's a place in life where we don't know, where we are just this wave in the ocean, and we have a trajectory, things happen, and we have to be in a mode that is exploratory, that is willing to shine a light in corners that may seem difficult or may elicit a lot of resistance. And yet in doing that, there's an alchemy, there's something very, very sacred, actually. It's not, it's because psychology. Okay, maybe I should stop here, and I'll let
No,
you.
I'm so happy to hear you flow with this. Also, for me, that's why I wanted to talk to you. That's the understanding that I've come to initially through just challenging mental health. So for me, it was more a beginning of working on my psychology. By default, I think if you do struggle like depression, panic disorder, you're naturally encountering the shadow through therapy, through the therapeutic method, through that understanding. So for me, there were quite a few years of that before discovering meditation. And it, like you say, there's a sacred nature to that work, and then also a refuge with non-duality. I think for me, that perspective, it felt quite pronounced quite early on in terms of this doesn't quite fit with the idea of like mental health. And I felt some non-dual teachings could actually set people back if they are struggling. Just from the entanglement with the difficulty and that kind of realization, that non-dual perspective, not like
Sometimes
just being hard to stabilize in, I guess.
I think it can do both. The non-dual teaching can be very misleading because it can send the message that suffering is an expression of is simply an expression of this belief in separation. So if you're struggling with depression or panic attacks or whatever, from sometimes a non-dual teaching can send you the message, that's because you believe that you're a separate self. So all you need to do is get rid of that belief, and then everything will be hunky-dory. And it doesn't work that way. So sometimes it does. Or rather, at some level it does. It's always a refuge, because our true nature is peace and openness and welcoming. So it's always the place we can go to when invited, because really we can't go to it. It's more like suddenly there's a feeling of just resting and abiding, and we're graced with the remembrance that all is well. But if we are under the illusion that we can take the non-dual teaching and then apply it to our suffering, you know, in a sort of conceptual way, all I need to do is get rid of this belief in separation, and then of course then it doesn't work, then we feel badly. Okay, why is it not working? I'm still that can be misleading, and it can keep us stuck in a way, you know, because we'll always have the moment where it sort of works, because we're back in the satsang and we're with everybody, and oh, it feels really good. It does. But then back out into the world of our daily lives and life, because, you know, in the end, it's life who's the teacher. Or rather, it's life who puts our understanding to the test. So whatever life is presenting, I think that in a way that is sacred for sure. And she will present things that are very difficult for all of us. And if we just reach for a spiritual idea as a sort of, you know, like, okay, life, yes, I'll take the good, but with the stuff that I don't like, I'm just going to apply the non-dual understanding.
Yeah.
It simply doesn't work. On the other hand, you know, psychology has become very mainstream and can be quite materialistic. It can be an endeavor that really fortifies the ego. You know, so many, and I'm, you know, it's just the way our culture is. There's so many things I can do to feel a bit better, and not just in the realm of spirituality, but in the realm of psychology and coaching and this and that and the other, and those things might be helpful. But I think the psychology I am drawn to isn't a feel better endeavor. It's more like a exploration endeavor of what it is to be human, I can't put it into words very easily, but what is my psyche telling me? What are my dreams telling me? What are my friends and my intimate partner? What has been mirrored back to me? And especially what has been mirrored back to me that I sort of want to, you know, okay, and to explore there and to be willing to postpone all the beliefs and ideas we have about ourselves, because what we know of ourselves usually is the surface, the ego, the persona, the image that we like to present to the world, that we know about. You know, if I asked you, you know, you would tell me, well, my name's Rick, and you'd have a whole way that you think of yourself. And that's very good and very healthy. But there's all sorts of other parts of Rick or Ellen that are also sort of wanting to claim a space in the psyche. The psyche is a bit like a democracy, and it's got all these different facets.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm aware as well, you have the Jungian background, and Jung's a big influence for me as well. And I like how you describe it in terms of, you know, not being a psychotherapy of getting or feeling better or like optimization, but actually just deep understanding. And I feel there is that paradox between like the more you understand, the more you delve into the mystery, the more you
Yes.
can feel held by it and supported by it. And it's this
That's nice.
willingness to confront that is really transformative.
Yeah.
With because I
And
with it, yeah, go on.
no, go ahead, Rick.
No, I was going to say, because I've got like my personal dialogue that I'm kind of tethering this line, like the personal dialogue, the questions I want to ask, and just holding awareness on people that are listening who might not have as much understanding. So I'm trying to just kind of choose between those two pathways. It might at this point be good to just give a brief overview of non-duality. And I also like you mentioned the Kashmir Shaivism branch of that. The I guess the experiential understanding of that, and some of the we mentioned the kind of misunderstanding, but the way that experiential perspective can be taken in a way that causes us. Or causes people to bypass the psyche and psychology. I hope that's a concise enough question, but just to kind of give that overview of why in particular non-duality and certain branches of the non-dual approach can lead to that unwillingness to approach the psyche in some sense.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I want to say that the so-called unwillingness, I know what you mean by that, unwillingness to approach the psyche, it's not, it's pretty common
Yeah,
because
that's true.
It's quite something to delve into a deeper exploration
Yeah.
of the psyche, especially in the sort of Jungian understanding of it, which we can talk about a little bit more. But yes, sometimes a spiritual understanding and the non-dual one is definitely a good candidate. A spiritual understanding can be a very good hiding place for the ego in a way. Is it can become a great way to avoid. Anyway, so non-duality. I'll just try to be quite brief because, you could go on for a long time.
People can go pause and Google if you're really lost at
Yes,
this point.
the non-dual tradition, it refers to a spirit. It's a spiritual tradition. In a way, it's the essence of all spiritual traditions, but then there's a specific lineage, as far as my teacher and his teacher, which is in comes from India, and Ramana Maharshi. I'll give you a few names. Ramana Maharshi on the Advaita Vedanta lineage, and then the Kashmir, which is the same understanding but a little bit different. I'm really being very simple here.
All good.
There's some sages from way, way back, a man called Abhinavagupta. Anyway, in these two lines of understanding, there is the recognition that there's only one reality, which we could call consciousness, and that we all share that reality, that there's only one being, that if we go and explore our experience, our direct experience, we can establish experientially that everything we experience, be it a thought, a sensation, a feeling, or a sense perception, such as the sound of my voice, is perceived by something that is neither a thought, a sensation, a feeling, or a perception. And we can explore even more. We can explore directly and experientially and establish that that which perceives, which we call I, and which we usually feel to be located as a body mind, we can begin to really challenge that belief experientially and to see directly. So it's not a seeing at a distance, it's a sort of recognition that I, the perceiver or the experiencer, is not located, that I can't really find a limit to that which perceives. And you can there are many, many ways that these traditions have devised to experientially really, really explore the nature of the perceiver, both conceptually. So the mind, because of course the mind arises in this. If I am not the thought, then therefore the thought can never sort of wrap itself around me, since the thought arises in me. So there are all sorts of ways that the mind can be taken to its uttermost limit of thinking about that which perceives, and then it collapses, and that collapse is a moment of understanding. And so the understanding is not cerebral. You might take conceptual steps to stretch yourself towards that understanding. The moment of understanding is just a pure understanding, which is not really, and then the mind rises up again to formulate the understanding. And that is also possible at the level of the body, where you can really on a tactile level, you explore the felt sense of the body. Of, for example, you might, all of us, if we close our eyes, the first, and we feel our bodies, we feel the sense, the very habitual sense of being located and weighted and limited. And I am here behind the eyes, behind the face, all sorts of habits, they can be challenged too, experientially. You can begin to feel or recognize that I don't live in the body, the body lives in me. And again, there are many, many, many pathways of exploration where it's as if you were returning the body to its true habitat, which is this field of openness. But in doing so, you have to encounter the habits of feeling located, separate. So that's the sort of very brief overview of the non-dual tradition, as far as I understand it. And it's a beautiful tradition. I mean, complete, you know, because you can explore your true nature using the mind and then using the body, and also using perception. You can really explore a sound and establish, you know, and ask yourself, well, where is the sound arising? You know, and then you can ask yourself, well, what is the sound made out of? You can ask yourself, what is a thought made out of? And then you arrive to the conclusion that everything's made out of the same stuff. I mean, I'm taking you very quickly, but
yeah. Something that also struck me with that, you mentioned like habit patterns, and like touching upon this idea of like the direct path and the progressive path, and the I see actually a lot of, kind of looping back to what we were saying, a lot of therapeutic approaches, if they were grounded in non-duality, would be their own kind of spiritual progressive path of, I'm not the depression, I'm not the anxiety, I'm not these kind of self-critical thoughts, leading back to that essential nature. Whereas the direct path, correct me if I'm wrong with this, like the direct path being going straight to the realization of awareness and being.
Right.
And I wonder as well,
Sorry, go ahead, Rick.
I was just going to say, I wonder if that is part of the gift and sometimes the curse for people, is that because there is that ability to go to awareness, it can be used as an escape almost to move through personhood and that kind of thing.
Yes. So I'll say two things. One is that often, so in this tradition, you start with the understanding or the possibility that you're not a person. You're absolutely right. So you're given sort of a pathway to take your stand or to recognize or to be open to that possibility. But then you do explore what is not, so the word that is used is the residual feeling of separation. So you, even though you know that you are that open field of limitless openness, you continue to align your beliefs and your felt sense to that understanding. So it's not like it's the end of the story. All I need to do is step back. I'm pure. That's it. No, in the traditions, you submit the body mind to this understanding, and you, but nevertheless, I think that there's still a very big danger of spiritual bypass. Simply because, this is a place where it's ho so hard to articulate. Simply because there is. That's why.
It's understandable, isn't it? It's like you say, it's common to avoid
Yes.
the like in-depth exploration, and when you actually have a practice that is giving you some form of
It's
escape and connection to peace, you can see the
yeah.
allure of wanting to bypass the darkness, so to speak.
Because also, even though in the non-dual pathways you do sit and you do explore the feeling of separation or you are doing it in the now. So you're not really wrestling with the actual story of, the actual drama of what's going on. That's a no-no, in most non-dual circles, you just don't get involved at all with those layers. So yes, you do attend to the contraction or certain beliefs, but you stay very close to the bone and very much in the now. And that I think that's very, very important, because it's as if you are immersing yourself in the essence of the truth. You're not bothered with my wife, my husband, my this, my, you're just going, you're dipping the body mind in the now. And so, yes, but it's also precious and important to give due, what's the word, due process to our lives, to things that happen to us in the drama of our lives, because the non-dual approach is really interested in the screen and will fix, pause the image, not interested in the film, just interested in the image of Rick and the screen, and wants Rick to reunite with the screen. But there's an important aspect to our stories. It's that I think each one of us, we have, we're not just random. There's a trajectory. We each have a sort of theme, or we have things that happen that recur. We have childhoods that had a certain quality that may require revisiting because they're still playing out. There's the fact that we belong to a greater community, and that things are happening in these communities that are, you could say, an expression of the collective unconscious, as Jung spoke about, which is a mirror of our own psyche. The collective psyche and the individual psyche are very, very related. And if we think that's not important, I think we are deluding ourselves.
Yeah,
I
I
mean,
agree. This is what, like, what you're talking to, I think, kind of defines also what you said at the beginning. Realizing they are actually the same, like the non-dual and the psyche and all of this is the same. But again, you point to the importance of establishing yourself in awareness or in essence or in that non-dual perspective, because we're so conditioned not to be there. It's almost like the necessity for that practice strengthens that connection, but it's not.
but only if you're interested. Not everybody's interested.
Only if you're interested,
I
yeah,
mean,
and called to
it is, it's here. I mean, it doesn't need to be established. It's what is, but when we're graced by a curiosity or desire to recognize and explore it, then by all means, I think, I mean, it's divine. It's divine. I mean, it's sacred. I don't know what to say about that. There's no way you wouldn't if you're invited to do that. And it's gonna call, it draws you back. It's the truth, if, I'm not being very clear here, but
No, I think it's the unclarity is relevant, because I think for a lot of people they feel that, right? Like ability, like you say, is always there. It's the backdrop or saturates your consciousness, pure awareness is always there. And yet we can feel disconnected from it. And I think the key is, as a paradigm shift, at least from talking from my experience, it's like that realization actually allows for less identification with my suffering and with my thoughts and with the content, which paradoxically has allowed me to explore the content
Exactly. That's
more.
beautifully said, Rick. I think that's very true. It's because suddenly you're touching just a spaciousness. And then suddenly suddenly it's you can explore creation. The psyche is really a micro, your psyche, my psyche is a microcosm of creation. Because a psyche is so it's there's so many layers to it, so many images, so many ideas, so many it's very alive. So yeah, when we recognize that we're not just this little ego, because the ego is just the tip of the iceberg, is so little. And suddenly we realize, no, oh, I'm the I, you know, my reality is really infinite. But then of course we still are this individual constellation, but suddenly it's like, oh, I don't need to stay just at the tip of the iceberg. I can sort of like, oh wow, look at that. Oh my God. Look, this phobia that I've had forever. Oh my God. And my childhood, that was so, and oh, the projection I have on this person. Let's have a look at that. Interesting. Instead of going, you know, I'm this person and then I have a projection on that person. I need to stay there because that's me up here. And part of what keeps me up there is my projection on that situation. But then suddenly, when you realize you're all of it, it's so much. You can swim, and I'm making it sound wonderful. It's not easy
Just
because you
swimming in
have
an ocean of bliss is
no, because you have to. It's not like you're just separate. You're not. You know, you're actually experiencing things very, very intensely.
Yeah, and
Not
I that's
avoiding. You're not avoiding.
that that's the difficulty, and I think so, something that we touched upon here as well is like sometimes with non-duality, it can lead to apathy and actually disconnect. Whereas again, the paradox of like the more you open the container of awareness, it a byproduct of that is to avoid suppression, to be willing to look, and through that, actually a more full embodied feeling, more of that. That content is there, but because there's not a so much of an aversion through that perspective, through the spaciousness, there's more feeling through that.
You're not defending a position. What I also think is important to say is that deep psychological exploration, I in my experience, can't be conducted only alone. That's why there are traditions of psychotherapy, I want to say, I don't like the word psychotherapy, but accompaniment, and where you're not on your own, somebody's there with you. And I think that's a very ancient tradition. And because Jung, you know how he talked a lot about alchemy, which is two elements. There's a transformation that happens through the sort of friction and mixing and all sorts of, I mean, I am not an alchemist, but and this happens really often. I think it happens intrapsychically on your own, but also with another in the field of relationship with so in the therapeutic world, you know, transference and countertrance, all sorts of, there's the jargon, but because the ingredient is very mysterious, the ingredient that allows for transformation, for things to integrate, for what Jung called individuation, where more of your selves get integrated into a sort of bigger self, you know, the all it. There's It happens through a process, and that process often involves a field with somebody else there, and slow, it's slow, it's not a quick thing, it's a work of a lifetime. And, it's working with dreams, maybe it's staying in a place where you have no idea, it's experiencing stuff that you've read in fairy tales, but much less glamorous. don't know, it's often requires the presence of another.
From that as well, I'd like to look at, I've seen you mention, I think I listened to one of your interviews, and it might have been the sand dialogue that I watched online. And kind of defining the horizontal and vertical plane and this relational aspect. You know, that's this connection, it's like non-dual connection is the idea of like it's eternal, it's ever present, it's unchanging. You could say like the masculine quality to use that energetically, like the Shiva quality. Mm-hmm. And then the creation, the ever-changing, the movement of form. I saw you in your blog post on the shadow as well, you described this so beautifully around like, yes, but like that eternal is there, but there is also the constant unchanging, the unfolding of creation.
Sorry.
And it does seem that frequently, when it is really important to kind of underscore that it's only a misunderstanding of non-duality. It's not non-duality in itself, but when it's conceptualized and applied relationally, mm-hmm. I feel it, that's also like a prime criteria of spiritual bypassing through the apathy, through the lack of like healthy attachment. And you said earlier about life being a lesson. I find the relational aspect, like you could be in meditation, you could be in your practice and be like, oh, I'm enlightened, this is great, you know, I mean, complete peace, enter a difficult dynamic, and all of a sudden it's like so they're two tracks, aren't they? They're different tracks of development, right.
Yeah, very well said, Rick. You see, you could have an enlightened person, in other words, a person who really has recognized their true nature. So when they sit in meditation, they genuinely are abiding as this field, and yet as a human being, as a person, as a man or a woman, they are, as you say, still, or not still, there's no obligation, but they are actually quite limited. They've done no mm-hmm. psychological work, not through any. They're not aware of attachment problems or trauma. They're used to operating with very sort of simplistic defenses, and it sort of worked. And then they have the spiritual understanding. So here the danger is obvious, that the spiritual understanding, the recognition that I am consciousness outside of the shrine will be taken, hijacked by the ego. The ego will say, I am universal consciousness. No, you're not. You're just all ego. I mean, you're made out of it, yes. And that is, I think, a very real danger of the ego getting inflated.
Mm-hmm.
The ego identifying with the formulations that in another space are genuinely, sincerely recognized or experienced, but now we're out of the shrine or the meditation, and mm-hmm. I'm dealing with my partner, and there's a real conflict, and I hate conflict. Uh-oh, there's a bit of anger showing up or whatever. I don't, and then, okay, I'm going to just grab for one of those spiritual truths. Here we are. I don't approve of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, like you see the temptation, and I wonder as well, the idea of the shadow, like the idea of the shadow being what we deny, what we repress. you can see how like the idea of what isn't spiritual can become the shadow. Like exactly what you say, you're in conflict, you've started to appropriate the idea of being enlightened. So you're like, well, enlightened people aren't angry. Anger comes up, push that
That's
away.
right.
Oh no, I'm too spiritual
Exactly.
for anger. And then the shadow
That's
is taking
right. So you,
control.
I, exactly. So I guess a good measure would be anytime you find yourself reaching for a certainty, pause and look left. There'll be an ugly thing there. Let go of the thing, the spiritual certainty, and face the ugly thing. And hopefully, you have the courage to do that. Or it takes courage, especially for those of us who have benefited from certainty and spirituality and the comfort of that, and it's hard to venture into territory where we're lost and confused and we come undone and we're a big mess and we it doesn't fit with the spiritual ideal. It
No.
doesn't.
And even I think as well, like a lot of ancient practices and teachings, like if you're in a monastery setting, those aspects, they're not going to be provoked in the same way. There's
That's
a
right.
reason there are different fields, and like a lot of interpersonal stuff. I do think spiritual traditions cover it, but maybe not in a language that fits or is so obvious with like modern living. But the need to really understand like the interpersonal, as
Yeah.
it's verifiable, like it's a really relevant track, and the different approaches there that non-duality can for sure help with. But you mentioned the word courage, and it does take courage. It takes courage to just own up to that messiness a lot of the time, I find, and just not getting carried away with an idea of where you're at or who you are, but just to be present to the full
Yeah,
range of
and it
emotions.
takes
And
courage. Yeah, and I inevitably I want to say then it takes courage to come back to the vertical. It's almost like that Jung talked about the tension of the holding the tension of the opposites. That really, it's all about living somewhere where you're constantly feeling that tug. That's the nature of being part of creation. It's you're never gonna. Yes, your reality is, but as a wave in that reality, it's a very dynamic process, and so, yeah, the flexibility and courage to sometimes to really move away from your drama and let it drop completely, and come back to the just to the now, where in the now, you. The story stops. So that takes courage too. So in a way, it's courage in both directions. So you have to be honest, and one has to be on. I have to be on. We all have, and see at any given moment where am I? How am I sort of seeking security? What blanket am I using? And recognizing just the fact of recognizing that will take you will allow you to take it off and be naked and see what happens next. And the blanket could be the spiritual formulations. It could equally be my drama. And it's going to be like that. It's going to be constantly a little bit of a.
That's a great way of describing it, because I feel that that is part of the wisdom of you can only learn that through experience, right? Where you see that, like you share that,
Yes.
and I'm thinking of times where I'm not validating like the messiness of the humanness through that spiritual kind of blanket. And I like that you mentioned as well, it does take courage to step back from habitual patterns, because they're addictive and they do feel good. Some maybe not good, but they have an addictive
Absolutely.
quality, and there is a sense of familiarity and safety. And those are the moments where to step back from that. I'm like, no, don't want to. I'm right. Like I'm kind of aggrandizing my point of view and my perspective. But to step back from that it's almost like it is a surrender of the ego in that sense, a surrender of the story that has its own gravitational pull. So that's something through trial and error, I can see that distinction of those learning to discern what blanket am I wearing, what approach do I need to take.
And I would go a step further and say, in order to sort of, in order for that to happen, that's where the Kashmir approach is really a beautiful preparation. Because in the Kashmir approach, so-called, we listen to the body without any agenda to change anything, but we but it's quite a honest look at the body, but from on a tactile level. So we sit and we just feel the body, and there's a few postures and a few breathing exercises, but it's really about being available to the body as it is, moment by moment, so that it's as if we were exercising our capacity to be with experience moment by moment, however unpleasant, pleasant it may be. So, for example, as I'm sitting in the Kashmir moment, and there's fear or anger, I completely submit to that feeling, to the wave of fear. So fear, you know, I completely submit what it, where, how, color, pulsation. And for no reason, I'm not trying to get rid of it. I'm not trying to sort of master fear. I'm just saying yes, 100% to that moment as best I can, which means that later outside of the shrine, in a situation with whatever, that here comes the wave of fear. Well, it's not that I'm going to know what to do with it. It's more that I'm going to be with it, and with the, and hopefully with the totality of the situation more, and I will be able to recognize that moment where I'm seeking, contracting, and just recognize it. Again, no judgment, no attempt to change anything. But in those moments, there's lots that can be discovered, insights, new possibilities open up, a memory may come in, you know. So it's a very essential practice that then outside will translate into widening this sort of field of our experience. And it's also a very loving practice, because it's saying all, everything is God-given, even every moment, every micro millimeter of experiences is
That also links to that what was mentioned earlier around the non-dual perspective being such a crucial element to exploring the psyche. As well, I think sometimes, like I this is maybe just me. It could be my own kind of way to narrow things down. But sometimes non-duality can sound sterile, almost. Oh, pure consciousness, therefore it lacks any vibrancy or any kind of quality. But in it, through that nature, like that non-duality, pure consciousness, you mentioned love, feelings of wisdom and compassion that spring from that source. So there is not only the awareness, but like you say, a loving, compassionate approach to yourself as you're experiencing the messiness, as you're experiencing the suffering, that opens up, you mentioned, like new possibilities, rather than being reactive and following a chain of reaction and kind of going from A to B, certain storylines, comments you're going to regret saying, ways that the body moves even. Like I know for me, like when I'm angry, like I really have to work to not be jarring in with my body and like wanting to move and escape. So there's that embodied element, but that love and compassion that can come in is the embodiment of the understanding in the moment. And like you say, that learning, like if you hold awareness on the body, and it does, you mentioned this in an interview as well, and I really like that. Like becoming aware of what else you discover just in the body. Like it's not just the immediate visceral fear, but there's actually more to the bodily experience. I really intrigued to get your view on this approach in terms of listening to the body. Because there is that, this question, this is like a loaded question, but there is that like deeper, what we're talking to, the wisdom of the body. There are also experiences where the immediate emotion isn't really to be trusted. So for example, like an anxiety over a thought, a fear-based thought, that could be seen as, oh, my body's telling me there's something to be worried about. How would you kind of discern between the wisdom of the body's intelligence and like emotions dictating in a way that can be misleading and reactive?
Well, I think I want, now I'm going to be more of a non-dualist. I'm going to say I wouldn't worry about discerning. I would be just dedicated to listening, whatever it is. So, because the wisdom of the body, it's not the wisdom of the body, it's wisdom, which sometimes wisdom meaning a sort of organic response to a situation on a feeling level that flows organically precisely because there's been a listening or an availability. In a way, the person, the separate self has relaxed or has seen itself for what it is, and therefore life just is moving or something like that. So that's wisdom that then comes through the body as I don't know, as a movement or as a breath that feels more full, or a lovely feeling usually when that flows. And equally because of your availability, meaning what I mean by availability is just an allowing of the range of experience, and here we're talking about the body, so sensations and feelings, to really unfold, postponing any conclusions, postponing any knowledge. So you were describing a moment where there might be an anxiety, a thought, an anxiety that tells you to do something. Well, in the moment of availability, you're postponing any knowledge. You don't even know, you're not really labeling things too much. You're just being with the wave of so-called anxiety, the wave of thinkingness, then you're welcoming the thought. And so that's at the moment where you're, I guess, practicing, you could say, practice. Out there in the world, you're doing, going about your business, something happens, you feel the thought and the anxiety and the conclusion and the and you there you have to hope for the best, because you're not sitting on your cushion, you're just living, you're not really doing, you're not being either spiritual or non, you're just being Rick. You have to gamble, spiritual gamble, that all the moments that you dedicate to understanding, to listening, to exploring, all of those moments that you dedicate to that are gonna translate in your daily life. And you may find that at the moment where the anxious thought appears and the contraction in the body, and then that there's also a like, oh wait, this, as you said, I think, let me just pause here. Let me just see if I can look at this from a more global perspective and feel, oh my, I know this anxiety so well. And then, oh my God, I feel tearful. Because, and then letting the layers surface, because there's never just one thing. Anxiety or anger are always the first face of something else and something else and something else. And that can become more available because you feel more connected to the totality, because it's safer. Because no, you're not a fragment. A fragment is anxious by definition. It's really anxiety provoking to feel yourself to be a fragment. But as you nurture the sense of belonging, connection, being part of the totality, then, as we, I think, said earlier, there's this natural possibility to allow the layers. So there's never just an anxiety without many other things. And there's always breathing, and there's always the earth under your feet and a friend nearby. I don't know, but there's always more than just one.
I really like that response, and that kind of, like you say, the spiritual gamble that the practice will translate. There is, you know, this also makes me think that, because there is that unknown, or that kind of mysterious quality. I find it when I started meditation, there is a leap of faith, like this is going to have some kind of byproduct or payoff without being attached to that. Like, that's the thing, like, not like I'm meditating
off
to get happy. It's like there is that alchemy.
If you meditate to become happy, you know, there's a certain innocence to that, and it's quite
there
natural.
Is, yeah.
And it's a first step. Like, no, I'm going to go meditate. I feel shit today. I'm going to go sit. Of course, you know, it's a little bit arrogant to say, you know, like, you know, I mean, you're not saying that, but we hear that, you know, no end gaining, no goals, no agenda. Well, maybe first to recognize, you know, there is an agenda. I really, and to feel the innocence of that. It's a little bit like the devotional path, or the child crying for her mother. A child needs her mother or his mother, and at certain moments this person desperately needs relief, meaning needs to come back to some kind of knowing of okayness, all is well, and that's a real need. And actually, there's, yeah, I think it's not something that we should think is wrong or spiritual. Correct. It gets purified all on its own. It's like just like a kid finds her mom, and then 2 seconds later, everything's fine. That she doesn't even remember she was crying. You know.
Yeah, that's so important, isn't it? Like, validating that we have human needs, like, regardless of our spiritual path or practice or how evolved we are, that we have some just quite fundamental and basic needs that sometimes
and we
just
have
need to be met.
Ugly knees, and we've got an angry witch in there, and we've got all sorts of creatures in our, that's the shadow, that have lots of needs. We've got animals in there, and wounded animals, and monsters, and I don't know, like, I don't, you know, you just have to look at your dreams, if you're lucky enough to remember them, and realize these are needs that have been locked away in basements that may need a bit of, we may need to go visit the smelly basements where there's a lot of shit. You know, why wouldn't we? How could we not? You know, I'm more and more, no, we need to do that. Look, otherwise, look what happens. Look at our culture. Look what happens when all those split off areas of our psyche, they're going to come up one way or the other, and make their way up, and it's going to be ugly, and, you know, understandably.
Yeah. And that's it, isn't it? It's part of the integration, having the courage to reclaim these parts, these fragments, and to avoid, like, pathological othering that our culture does so well, to really just create such solid boundaries between, like, the enemy and...
Exactly. I mean, at the moment, it's quite remarkable how that's happened.
Yeah. I'd like to, because I'm conscious of time as well. I mean, how are you doing? Have you got about half an hour? Right. Maybe a bit less. I could see your face as well.
Sorry. Maybe 50. 15 minutes.
15.
Is
That's
that
good. Okay. I'll just check.
20
Check.
minutes?
20 minutes.
Because
Okay.
I've
That
got
that's.
half past, that's why.
Okay. Yeah. To give you a bit of a bridge in between. I'm going to try and tie this together as one question, but I was also really fascinated to see that you spent time with Marion Woodman,
Oh.
the Jungian mythopoetic of inspiration, really, in terms of that feminine path. I really value this idea of like your approach as well in terms of talking of integration, like the need almost to reintegrate the feminine into the totality of spirituality, psychology, and a lot of the suppression that's taken place in terms of that approach. This isn't a question yet, because what we've spoken about is this idea of like descending into the underworld as well, and like being with all of that stuff, which could be seen as more of a feminine path. I'd like to, I guess, bridge into that, into the idea of mystery. And you know, this idea, I think a lot of the time, like myself included, the quest for self-inquiry can be sometimes camouflaged as actually just a desire to know. And you mentioned the path of like devotion as well. And I just wonder how you relate to this idea of like devotion and mystery as part of the path. Yeah, so not so much a question, but a bit of
Yeah, a ramble.
a ramble that gives you a
Well,
chance.
I didn't mean a ramble, I meant when you go on a walk, a meander.
Meander, yeah. Meandering around the point of like the divine feminine and how that relates and what could be done to I guess find more wholeness in spiritual approaches.
Well, I'm just struck by how you talk about self-inquiry and then the descent and also the devotional path. So sort of three branches. And I feel like self-inquiry is not a descent. It's more like okay, I don't know what it is, but it's not a descent. The descent is, you know, we find it in myths. I love that you mentioned Marion Woodman, or ritual endeavors, shamanic endeavors, in all traditions, for as far back as we know, there were practices of descent. And as you say, I like that you sort of associate it to a feminine approach, even though it's a little tricky to genderize those kinds of initiatory paths. There's something about it that's descending, so earth going under the underworld, lots of myths. Inanna's myth in ancient Sumeria, it was the goddess, you know, or Persephone in the Greek tradition, going under and being initiated into the realm of death. And it's all to do with It was all to do always in those ancient myths with nature and the cycles of life and death and being initiated. It's hard to talk about, but and with Marion, when I went to her, she would do these wonderful 10-day workshops for women. They were deeply initiatory. We would work with dreams, we would make masks, we would use the body a lot, and there would be a dimension of not knowing, a really honoring the realm. The descent is really a descent of surrendering the known. And then somehow you come up again at the end, having reclaimed or reintegrated. But you've been there's something difficult there. So that would be maybe that would be what we were talking about earlier, would be the cycle, the work of exploring the psyche, of diving in, of going, it's something dark there, something dark. Whereas the self-inquiry, it's light. We're exploring our true nature. There's something more almost of an ascent or an opening. So you, in a way, it's in the first, in the descent, we're looking at God's hidden face. We're looking for God's hidden face, whereas in the self-inquiry, we're looking for God's shining face. The truth of in the now is not in hiding. And maybe we could say that patriarchy, the structure of patriarchy, which is not men, it's I think our has favored light and sort of certainty and rationality and and has in many, many ways pushed away, disclaimed, hurt a whole aspect of experience, which is darker, shadier, more ambiguous, more about paradox, more about the hidden realms. So I think you clearly are very interested in reuniting those, you know, sun and moon, gold and silver, you know, those, again, it's all about intention of the opposites. And devotion, I would have thought, can go in both directions.
Yeah.
You know, you can be devoted to the goddess of, or to the not knowing. And you can be devoted to the known, to the truth. And why would you have to choose between those two? I hope that helps, or well, not helps, but goes
no,
in the direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like this idea of devotion going both ways. And even the fact that, you know, we use the term enlightenment or like illumination when it comes to that sunny face. And then the idea of like depression, like what you're moving in that downward direction and.
Undarkenment.
Yeah. Go through an undarkenment process. Yeah. And I think it is like,
well, you know, some people say waking up and waking down.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it.
I mean, I do feel there has been a favoring of transcendence and there's this sort of pull down a bit that I feel sometimes. Coming back into the body, into the messy, into be willing to just be messy, just be angry if you're angry, just be what you are, and let her, the goddess, life, show you something. Simply because you're submitting to the messy moment, you can be sure that she'll show you something if you're courageous enough to just have a good cry. Just have a good cry, you know, like, or have a good howl, or express your anger, be really furious, and then something is going to happen. That there's a teaching there. There's something there that's so precious. And it's simple too. It doesn't have to be like complicated ideas about psychological this and that. And it's
exactly.
Basic, basic, basic.
Yeah, it's very, very immediate process, isn't it? Rather than having to philosophize it. There was a quote. I think it was also from your San talk, where you describe that manifestation as an emission of consciousness. And I bring that up now because, as you say that, it makes me think of that almost like integral separation that has been created through this idea of, ironically, of non-duality, like a separation between what is earthly, what is spiritual, and the need to reconcile. I sometimes use the word enchantment as like the experience of, I guess, divine two-ness, you know, like I'm loving the subject object like apparent separation, but the underlying unity to that, which for me is the most enriching experience compared to certain states of meditation, like actually being in the world and immersed in it with a reconnection to the sacred. That for me, I'm like, this is it.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I want.
I mean, look at you and we're talking right now. There's like Rick and Ellen, and there's screens and mics and ideas, and it's so much fun. And I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Something about that is divine. And if we were to clinically try to find the duality here, we wouldn't be able to find it, but we would find a sort of bouquet of expression of and we would realize, oh my God, wow, the friendship and the discoveries and the rhythms of our conversation
It
and
had its
also
own.
different parts like me thinking, okay, I need to get off because I need to or whatever. The whole thing, you know.
And then me being like, oh, I'm taking up too much space. There's too much time. We've ran over. I bet it's a great conversation. I don't want to ruin it. But yeah, on that note, we will draw to a close. Thank you so much.
I could always have another one down the line.
I would love to. I would really enjoy that. That would be awesome. Do you have anywhere to point people in terms of your work and your offerings for people listening?
Well, I my website, I do regular webinars and also not so regular, but little retreats, and so they can come to my website, Ellen Emmett. www.ellenemmett.com.
Perfect. Thanks so much for joining me
Thank
today,
you.
Alan.
Thank you so much, too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM. You'll also get a copy of my book, Mindsets for Mindfulness, when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format, along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRizz. That's DERISZ.